From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in Davos, Switzerland today, meeting with world leaders at the World Economic Forum. He is the first sitting U.S. president to go since Bill Clinton in 2000. NPR's Scott Horsley is traveling with the president and joins us from Davos. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And how's he being received so far?
I think warily. I mean, Davos is kind of the mecca of globalization and a potentially hostile audience for the president's America First message. That said, the president plans to do his best salesmanship job here. He's trying to recruit more foreign investment to the U.S., saying that brings jobs to the folks back home. But he's also going to confront the international community about what he sees as unfair trade practices and other ways in which he thinks America has kind of gotten the short end of the stick.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what he said this morning. He was meeting with Theresa May, the UK prime minister, and he said to expect huge increases in trade between the two countries.
We're working on transactions in terms of economic development, trade, maybe most importantly, military. We are very much joined at the hip when it comes to the military.
And we heard something very similar from the UK Prime Minister Theresa May. Let's listen.
And alongside that, working for a good trade relationship in the future, which will be to both our benefits. So the UK and the US both do well out of this. And it's been great to see you today.
Now, when you hear her say that, talking about more trade between the UK and the US, we think of Brexit. Of course, she's having to figure out what will be next when the UK has a different relationship with Europe. Do you expect there to be more trade announced between Britain and the U.S.?
Possibly, although they've been talking about that for a long time and we haven't seen any real action yet. Certainly, President Trump is much more receptive to the idea of a one-on-one trade agreement between the U.S. and the U.K. than his predecessor, Barack Obama, was. In the run-up to the Brexit vote, remember, Obama warned the British people, look, you pull out of the EU, you're going to have to go to the back of the line. We're trying to strike multilateral trade deals. President Trump has exactly the opposite idea. He doesn't like multilateral trade deals, so a one-on-one agreement with the UK might be in the offing.
President Trump also spoke today with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and he was talking about the aid that the U.S. gives to the Palestinians.
We give them tremendous amounts, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. That money is on the table. Because why should we do that as a country if they're doing nothing for us? And what we want to do for them is help them. We want to create peace and save lives. And we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. But the money is on the table.
What's your take on that, Scott? That seems pretty significant that he said that.
We should say that the U.S. has already put some economic aid to the Palestinians on hold, and the president is threatening to withhold more if the Palestinian leadership doesn't agree to come to the bargaining table with Israel. You hear there the very transactional way that this president views America's use of its foreign aid dollars. Of course, he didn't talk about the larger sums that the U.S. contributes to Israel in that equation. This was the first time that Trump and Netanyahu have met face-to-face since Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and to move the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv. He criticized the Palestinians, who were very unhappy with that move, for refusing to meet with Vice President Pence when he was in the region not long ago. And as you heard, he threatened to withhold more funds from the Palestinians if they don't come to the bargaining table.
You mentioned that President Trump does not like multilateral trade agreements. We know that he pulled the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. The headline in the New York Times today is that the U.S. is pushing America first while the world moves on. Is that your sense at Davos, that maybe people are just saying, okay, if he doesn't want to trade with us, we're going to just trade with each other?
That's certainly the signal that other countries are trying to send. Now, the United States is still an enormous market, and other countries really can't afford to simply ignore the United States. But we saw the announcement this week of the other 11 countries that were in the TPP moving ahead, making a deal, and the United States being on the outside looking in.
What are you going to be watching for in tomorrow's speech?
What is the balance the president strikes here between putting out the welcome mat for foreign investments and, on the other hand, sort of beating up on the global community for what he sees as unfair trade practices and other unfair practices? You know, how much of this is going to be welcome to America and how much is going to be America first?
That's NPR's Scott Horsley traveling with the president in Davos, Switzerland. Scott, thanks.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And by the way, President Trump gave an interview to CNBC today and said he would consider reentering the TPP trade deal if the terms were more favorable to the U.S.
Well, this week, President Trump tweeted, if there is no wall, there is no DACA or protection from deportation for the 800,000 now adults who are brought to the U.S. as children. Recipients have to renew every 2 years to get work permits, but Congress has set February 8th as a deadline for extending the program itself. And last night, the president went off Republican message and said this about citizenship for recipients.
We're going to morph into it. It's going to happen
at
some point
in
the future. Over a period of 10 to 12 years, somebody does a great job. They've worked hard. It gives incentive to do a great job.
Barbara Pinto is senior staff attorney at Centro Legal de la Raza in Oakland, California. And Barbara, heads must be spinning. Talk of citizenship, but you're hearing fears of deportation.
Well, in addition to that, they'll lose their permission to work here lawfully. DACA recipients are professionals. They're teachers, counselors. They're working in things they graduated from college. And then the fear is that they'll have to try to find a job that maybe pays under the table. They can lose health benefits. They won't have a valid Social Security. So for a brief moment, and we don't know how long this period is going to last, USCIS is accepting DACA renewal applications. And so we have DACA recipients that are applying in hopes that their protection can be extended for another 2 years.
But are you finding that people are maybe not signing up for their extension and going back into the shadows?
There are some people that are very nervous and very anxious that maybe they've changed address or contact information, and then now they're a little bit apprehensive and don't want to submit another renewal application. Well, they'll be giving that personal information again. You know, they're trying to be optimistic, but at the same time, this information is constantly changing and has a huge impact on their lives. And they're feeling like every day there could be a drastic change as they wait while politicians negotiate their fate in this country.
Well, and is there anything else that DACA recipients can do legally?
There are some coming to our office seeking representation on their DACA applications. We have found that they are eligible for more permanent types of relief. So, for example, maybe they were a victim of a crime in the United States and are eligible for a U visa, or maybe they recently got married to a U.S. citizen and they're eligible to adjust their status through that spouse.
And what's the U visa?
The U visa is a legal status for those that have been victims of a violent crime in the United States and have cooperated with law enforcement, and that has a path to citizenship.
When you say have cooperated with law enforcement, this is something that undocumented people are leery of doing. They don't want to come out of the shadows to go report a crime because they're afraid they also will be deported.
Right. And nowadays it's more difficult for them to do so because of the trust issue. Mm-hmm. And so there are individuals that come to our office that have been victims, but because of that fear, years ago, they just never reported it to the police and never came forward. Mm. And these are, of course, this is a very small population that comes to our office seeking help with DACA and are actually eligible for something else.
We were hearing of people trying to sell their property that they own here. But what kinds of questions are you getting from people who don't know what the outcome is going to be?
We've had people not go to work, not take their children to school, or tell us that they just don't want to continue living their normal lives for fear that they'll be detained at any point or deported. We've also heard from families, even DACA recipients that have U.S. citizen children, that are trying to find ways to make sure they can set up some sort of guardianship or something like that where their kids can stay with somebody here if they were deported. But we keep reminding people that they have rights to remember that if they are approached by ICE or law enforcement, that they have the right to remain silent, they have the right to speak to an attorney, they have a right to ask for a hearing in front of a judge, and so they don't have to sign their deportation and leave the next day. They can go through a process in order to fight in their deportation proceedings to be able to have a chance to remain in the United States.
And are they asking you about the legal questions around the path the Trump administration has taken? Because we know there's a lawsuit brought by some immigrant advocates and Democratic local and state officials saying the White House acted improperly in eliminating DACA. A judge in California agreed with them. There was a nationwide injunction. But then the Trump administration appealed that, asked the Supreme Court to rule on the appeal. So it's really all tied up.
Yes, we've been getting nonstop calls and people walking in asking what that means for them. Our advice to DACA recipients is to apply now in hopes that their application will arrive to USCIS and be adjudicated or processed, or at least in the beginning stages of that, before anything else changes. And hopefully if something does happen and there is a change, then maybe those applications that were already in process would continue to be adjudicated. We're telling them, you know, we don't know. This is what we hope will happen and this is what we're shooting for, but anything can change. And it's tough when you're having that conversation, you know, generally with somebody, especially an adult in their 20s or in their early 30s. But we're having these conversations also with teenagers in high school. It's heartbreaking.
That's Barbara Pinto, immigration lawyer in Oakland, California. Barbara, thank you.
Thank you very much.
California Governor Jerry Brown delivers his final State of the State address today in Sacramento. Brown is the longest-serving governor in state history. He was elected twice in the 70s and then again in 2010 and 2014. The governor is fond of quoting Latin. He was famously called Governor Moonbeam in the 1970s for attracting California's young idealistic voters. And in the past year, he has led California's charge against the Trump administration. Joining us now is Scott Schaefer, senior politics and government editor at KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy.
And when Governor Brown took office for the second time in 2011, California was dealing with a budget crisis that he called real and unprecedented. How would he describe the state of the state in his final year in office?
Well, I think he would say, and others would say, that it's fixed to a large degree. That's not all his doing. But, you know, before he took office, there was a lot of talk in the national media about questions like, is California ungovernable? And I think that question has been answered. California has led the nation in job creation. The unemployment rate is the lowest I think it's ever been in the state's history. There's a budget surplus. He inherited a massive deficit. And through economic growth and recovery and some other things, the state is definitely much better off than it was when he founded in 2011.
Well, one of the things that he has that a lot of governors do not have around the country is he's got a legislature that is overwhelmingly supportive of his agenda. How has he been able to use that supermajority in the state legislature to his advantage to help deal with these problems?
Yeah, well, he didn't always have the supermajority, but he has for the last couple of sessions. Well, just in the last year, for example, he got an extension with a two-thirds vote of a cap-and-trade program used to rein in greenhouse gas emissions, a two-thirds. And he got a lot of Republicans, too. He didn't actually just do that with Democrats. He got about seven or eight Republicans who joined him in that. So it has enabled not just him, but the leaders in the legislature to get through things that would never have gotten through, including the budget. You know, when Jerry Brown became governor, there was a need for a two-thirds vote to pass a budget. And the voters changed that. And it's just now a simple majority like most states. Hmm. And that in and of itself has really solved a lot of the problems.
How different is the job of being governor now compared with when Jerry Brown was elected for the first time back in 1974?
Well, everything's different, right? I mean, you just think about the changes in technology. There was no Apple. There was no, of course, Twitter.
By the way, two companies based in California, which is important as we talk about some of the big economic drivers of the state.
Sure. Google, Facebook, they're all here. Oracle, you know, you go right down the line. Most of them are based here in California, you know, and so it's a more complicated world, a more interdependent world. And of course, now with the election of Donald Trump, California has become sort of the vanguard of, quote unquote, resistance to the Trump agenda. And so in some ways, Jerry Brown is sort of the president of California now. You know, he's out there negotiating his own greenhouse gas emission pacts with other states and other nations even. So, you know, he has risen to the complexity of this world that we live in. live in right now. And in some ways, I mean, I think everyone expected that he'd be dealing with a Democratic governor, but now a president rather. But now having Trump there, he has become a major foil to President Trump and his agenda.
Well, and I want to get to that, but let's first go back. I want to listen to a piece of tape from 1976. This is Jerry Brown speaking on 60 Minutes, pointing out that California was saddled with paying for things that used to be the responsibility of the family.
The state is supposed to provide child care. It's supposed to provide food stamps. It's supposed to provide nursing homes. You name it. The next thing we're supposed to do is give workmen's compensation for wives. And maybe that's a good idea. But when you cost out all the things that people used to do for free, the cost is astronomical.
That sounds like a very different Jerry Brown than in 2018.
That is so interesting. But you know what is very consistent is Jerry Brown in that clip we hear, and now, and in the past 7 years, he is very, I would say, frugal. Some might say cheap, but he's frugal. You know, there was a joke going around Sacramento that the most powerful Republican in Sacramento is Jerry Brown, because he has been the person who has put the brakes on the Democrats' often, huge appetite for spending and social programs.
Jerry Brown left office in 1983 after two terms as governor, but stayed in politics. He was the Secretary of State. He was the mayor of Oakland. Remind us about what he was doing in between his stints as governor.
Yeah, and you know, it's one other thing to point out is that Jerry Brown, when he took office in 1975, he turned around the next year and ran for president in 1976, and then he did it again in 1980. And by the time he left office the first time he was governor, he was much less popular. People were tired of Jerry Brown. And so he kind of laid low for a long time. He went and worked with Mother Teresa, you know, in Calcutta. He was very, very much trying to find himself, reinvent himself in a way. He came back later as mayor of Oakland. A lot of people thought he was just going to use that as a launching pad to run for statewide office. He stuck around for 2 4-year terms as mayor of Oakland. And I think that time really shaped him. And so that and the experience of becoming attorney general, which he did before he ran for governor the second time, has really, you know, shaped him and I think made him a very, very different governor this time around than he was the first time.
One of the big issues for Jerry Brown, as you have mentioned, is climate change. Let's listen to him last year speaking again with 60 Minutes, railing against the climate policies of President Trump.
I don't think President Trump has a fear of the Lord, the fear of the wrath of God, which leads one to more humility. And this is such a reckless disregard for the truth and for the existential consequences that can be unleashed.
How has Jerry Brown gone up against the Trump administration?
In every way imaginable. In that tape there, Jeremy reminds me that, you know, Jerry Brown was a seminary student when his dad, yeah, Pat Brown, was governor. He has he actually, in the first year that after Trump was elected, he put $6.5 million into the state budget to hire more lawyers to sue the Trump administration and to defend California's policies. You know, and the California has now sued the administration more than 40 times on everything from climate change to the travel ban, immigration issues, you know, all those things. So, he has, and of course, he's been very outspoken more than anything, probably, on climate change. At the same time, though, you know, California is a state that's prone to disasters. And so he has tried to pick his fights carefully, Jerry Brown has. You know, he has gone to the federal government several times during the last few months for wildfires and floods and mudslides. And every time the Trump administration has said yes to the requirement, the need for more federal funding to help with these disasters. So he has, tried to walk that line and not alienate the Trump administration because he knows that, states need the federal government.
What was his biggest failure?
His biggest failure? Well, I think that there are a couple things that he has not accomplished, several things, really. But I think the things that were on his agenda that he hasn't done, in particular, is to fix the water conveyance system. You know, California is extremely reliant on snowfall in the Sierra, and that water melts in the spring, and it goes through a complicated ecosystem. And he's been wanting to develop some tunnels to kind of fix the problems with the ecosystem. He has not made much progress on that. I would say that's probably the biggest issue. And that was an issue the first time he was governor. There was something called the Peripheral Canal, which was going to get water from the north to the south, and the voters rejected that. It's water is it's the lifeblood of California, right, in many ways. And that's an something he can't check off the to-do list for sure.
Well, and by the way, he faced droughts in both times as governor, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, the last one extended for at least half of the time he's been governor, 4 or 5 years. And so he's very acutely aware of that issue and the fact that climate change, you know, is going to perhaps permanently change California's climate. We can't rely on the snowfall the way we have in the past.
I want to play one more piece of tape. This is from 2013, Jerry Brown speaking to an interviewer from The Atlantic who has just asked a question using a Latin phrase.
I'm glad you're starting to use Latin in this interview. Sui generis means of its own kind, by the way. Genitive, singular. Anyway, I had to show that off.
What's the sui part?
Of oneself. It's a pronoun.
So he knows his Latin. I remember interviewing him, and I asked him what his favorite place in California was, and he said, no surprise, the Oakland Hills, which is where he lives. But he's a very interesting guy.
He is extraordinarily. He's an intellectual, and you don't find that in politics these days. And he's not afraid to show it. He loves talking about things that are biblical in nature. You know, he's been a big advocate of criminal justice reform. And I asked him once, "Do you believe in redemption, in second chances?" And his eyes lit up. You know, and he talked about his Catholic faith and having been a Jesuit for seminary student. So he loves that intellectual part of living, and he has managed to really make that a part and parcel of being governor as well.
So who is going to replace him?
Well, the leading candidate at this point, and there are about 6 or 7 people running, is the lieutenant governor, Gavin Newsom. He was mayor of San Francisco. He's now lieutenant governor. He'll be introducing the governor as, you know, he introduces the governor before the State of the State speech. He's been ahead in all the polls. He's raised a lot of money behind him. Antonio Villaraigosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles. And there are other folks running as well, the state treasurer. So it remains to be seen, Jeremy. The election is in June. At this point, I think everyone would agree that Gavin Newsom is the one to beat, but he is beatable. I mean, he hasn't been above maybe 30% in the polls. So, you know, I think voters have been so fixated on what's happening in Washington that they haven't really focused yet on the governor's race here.
That's Scott Schaefer, who is senior politics and government editor at KQED in San Francisco. Scott, thanks.
You're welcome.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of Ask Me Another. We headed out to L.A. for 2 all-celebrity contestant shows, and the competition was more intense than the traffic on the 405. Linda Cardellini, Jeff Garlin, Lance Reddick, and Paul Rust. Only one took home an Ask Me Another Rubik's Cube. Find Ask Me Another on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Supreme Court is considering a New Jersey-based case that could give states the go-ahead to legalize sports betting beyond Las Vegas, the only place where it's now legal. Major sports leagues have spent millions fighting lifting the ban on betting, but now one of them, the NBA, is pivoting, asking for a cut of the pot and more access to betting for fans if the ban is overturned. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So this is all from testimony from the NBA attorney in New York yesterday. Flesh out more of what the league might want.
Right. So like a good point guard, the NBA is seeing the play before it happens. And you're right. There is this law in there's a federal law banning sports betting except in Nevada. And it's named after Bill Bradley, the former Knicks and Princeton player, the Bradley Law. And that's why there's no sports betting in America. But New Jersey, under then governor, as of a few days ago, then governor Chris Christie, wanted to overturn that law. All the leagues opposed it, but they opposed it on the state level. They are kind of wary about 50 different states with 50 different rules. They'd rather have one federal law. The sports leagues that are up in front of this issue. So the NBA is very forward thinking. They know how much money is bet on sports. They'd rather not have all the states do it individually. They'd like a federal law. They'd like 1% of everything wagered. And so they're making their play now. They're opposing this, what the Supreme Court is doing, which is hearing an overturn of the federal law. They want a new federal law that allows them to participate in crafting the law and to get a lot of money based on everyone who puts a wager on a game.
Right. 1%, that's a lot of money. And they also want, as we said, more access for fans, not just, you know, in casinos and resorts. What would that be?
Okay, that's huge because under the reason a state would want to change this is so that they could control the wagering. There's a lot of racetracks, for instance, in New Jersey, and there's racinos, and there's riverboats. Indiana's talking about a law or has a law introduced that would allow sports betting on the riverboats. But the NBA is saying, no, do it in everyone's home. Have it on everyone's smartphone. Have it during a game so you can bet on will the player make the next free throw. This will take the amount that's bet. Legally, it's maybe $1 billion. There's a total of $5 billion bet on all sports in Las Vegas. So maybe on the NBA, you get $1 billion of that. But this will, if you add in how much is already bet illegally, this could take it into the hundreds of billions of dollars. So we're talking tens of millions of dollars in revenue for the NBA and any of the other leagues that decide to get on board with this.
Well, we know the NBA studied what's happening in Australia and France with pro leagues getting a small percentage of bets. But what, I mean, yeah, okay, the money, we hear that. But betting was always seen as a corrupting influence. You know, players would throw games. What happened
yes.
to that?
It was true. It was more corrupting when salaries were so low that a gambler or a dirty gambler offered a bigger payday than your boss. You know, the 1917 Black Sox, Charles Comiskey was not paying the players, so gamblers got involved. But the difference is, the professional athletes are so well paid, it's seen that it would be very rare that a gambler would have influence. And also, it is true that if you can really check the trends of everyone betting and you could see anomalies where someone bet a huge amount of money on some chance outcome and it happened, that would be really helpful in investigation. And in fact, some colleges, there have been a history of the NCAA using these gambling patterns to successfully prosecute gamblers trying to throw college games.
Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst and host of the daily podcast, The Gist. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Ann Litt is a DJ with KCRW in Santa Monica, California, and joins us once again. Hi, Ann.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. And you have brought us some music for 2018. Is this going to be a good year for music, do you think?
It's going to be a good year. Rock is back, in case you had missed that memo.
Did it go away?
It went away for a minute, and it's back a little bit, at least so far. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of great music coming this year. I've sort of been flooded with it. It was really hard to choose this week.
Okay, well, one of your choices is Erica Wennerstrom. This is called Extraordinary Love. Erica Wennerstrom is the leader of the Ohio-based band Heartless Bastards, but this is a solo project.
It is. She's taken a break, or they've taken a break, but they're coming back. They insist that we know they're coming back. And she kind of went on a journey of self-discovery, and that's where this album started and where it ended. And the song, gosh, it's all about having love and love for yourself, and you can't love others until you love yourself. It's, I think, the thing I love about her, I mean, besides the fact that she is a badass of massive proportions, is that she can be this rock badass woman, and yet she's so vulnerable in her songwriting.
And it's got echoes of the 60s and 70s, definitely.
Oh, absolutely. And good echoes, in my opinion.
All right, well, next we have the Australian Hamish Anderson. This is the song You.
I can't resist you, but I got nothing left to give you. I've fallen before, always left wanting more. Sometimes I feel it's all about to break, holding on to thoughts, man, I thought that I would shake.
handshake of you. Oh, you. And you know now, darling, that I can't shake you.
First of all, Anne, thank you for bringing us this song because I feel so relaxed right now after listening to it. But Hamish Anderson has been called the young act under 30 to watch out for.
Well, he certainly is. And, you know, he grew up in Melbourne, Australia, but had this love of American music, roots, rock and roll, and particularly the blues. And he sort of adds this soul to it as a guy who's completely obsessed with American music. And he's created something that I also think is a rock and just, like you said, relaxing. It's beautiful. And his whole album is fantastic. I have to tell you, Jeremy, I slept on this one. This album came out in October of 2016. Huh. And it wasn't until about, I know, that, but that's why I want you to know about him and the world to know about him. I discovered him in sort of October of 2017. And now he played actually in Los Angeles last week. And like Erica, from whom we just heard, he also has an intimacy and a vulnerability in his songs as well. Yet it's still, you know, rock. It's there. It's present.
Okay, next we have the song Friday Morning. This is by the Texas band Crewing Bin. Now, Crewing Bin means airplane in Thai, which is partially where this band finds their influence, the Thai funk music of the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm, exactly, and sort of surf rock. Yet they're from Houston, Texas, and they record their music in a barn that's situated halfway between Houston and Austin. So they're sort of this wonderful creation of juxtapositions and of unexpected sounds.
Now, we can hear a voice in this track, but most of the music is instrumental, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And, you know, they were just at KCRW a couple of weeks ago for a live session, and they were talking about how they were never really intending to sing on any of them, but yet the voice has seemed to work on some of these. And what they said is when they were making Con Todo El Mundo, their album that's coming out in March, they were listening to a lot of singers and a lot of horns, and that's where they really found the melodies, they said, for this album. And if it is a progression from their previous work, just having heard this one song, we're going to be blown away.
Okay, well, now let's go to the Austrian duo Leia. This is called Drum Solo. More upbeat, kind of bouncy. What do you like about this song, Anne?
Well, I think it's a great take on catchy pop music, but it's not a straight-ahead saccharine take. It's this sort of angular, weird take. It's sunny, but they've got a little spin on the ball with it. It's a duo out of Vienna, Austria. And they're really, I think, taking pop music and turning it upside down. It's experimental, it's fresh, and it's full of all of these different layers. And I was reading an interview with them where they said that they hope that these layers created a world where, depending on how you were feeling, what mood you were in, you could take something different away from the song each time you heard it.
Okay, well, we have time for one more, and this one is a little different. Here is Danza de Gardenias. This is by Natalia Lafourcade.
Palomito blanco, no le llores tanto a tu paloma negra, Marisol morena, siempre te amará. volado por el cielo y pronto libre volarás. Ay, que me parte el alma, que muera la esperanza y toda la dulzura del amor en ti.
And this is actually a return for Natalia Lafourcade on the DJ sessions, because when we went to Mexico City with the show back in April, we spoke with a DJ there and he brought us a song from her as well.
Well, that just shows you, that's a testament to her artistry that she's back again.
Yeah, and she's a Mexican pop rock singer.
Exactly. And this song is the first taste we've heard of her next album, which is called Musas Volume 2. Musas Volume 1 actually won a Latin Grammy for Best Folk Album. And what she's doing here is taking traditional music and showing that it can be modern and fresh. And she's so celebrated. She uses musicians from all over Latin America. Same with her instrumentation as well.
And how did you discover her?
I discovered her actually from another KCRW DJ, Raul Campos, back in 2015 on her album Hasta la Raiz. I think she's on like her fifth album or something, but I was so taken with her, and I think it's because of what we were talking about with this song, is that she takes the old and the new and she sort of puts them together in a way that feels modern, and I love that about her.
That's Ann Litt, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Ann, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And you can find all of our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify, search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
As lawmakers debate immigration, it's playing out on the border with Mexico. The American volunteer group No More Deaths helped produce a report released last week claiming Homeland Security agents sabotage humanitarian efforts. Videos show agents kicking over jugs of water left in the desert by volunteers for people crossing illegally.
So you get a good shot. Pick up this trash somebody left on the trail.
Well, that same day, agents detained volunteer Scott Warren on charges of harboring people illegally after he took several border crosses to a No More Deaths safe place. Alicia Dinsmore is also a volunteer with No More Deaths. And Alicia, some say agents were once more accepting of your work, but you say the harassment has been going on for a while.
Yeah, I think it's a little complicated. It's important to know that the report that we released last Wednesday, January 17th, was a report that used data coming from 2012 to 2015, and it documents 3,586 gallons being destroyed. On average, we find our water destroyed two times a week in southern Arizona, and we believe that Border Patrol is responsible for the majority of this destruction. So even before the Trump administration came into office, we were seeing interference with humanitarian aid. And that's not just with these water gallons, these life-preserving supplies that we put out. Our volunteers also experienced harassment, threats of detention, their vehicles being run off the road by Border Patrol agents. Border Patrol agents in the field surveilling them and following them on foot, on horseback, on ATV. Things like this are really common for humanitarian aid providers in southern Arizona and has an impact on our ability to provide humanitarian aid for those who are crossing.
Well, you know, you call it humanitarian aid. The border agents in many cases called it littering, and that's, you know, it's under that charge that they arrested some of the volunteers, but a court overturned a littering conviction against at least one of your volunteers for leaving these gallons of water in the desert. But can you try to see the point of the agents that leaving water out, something you see as life-saving, might actually be luring people into this false sense of safety? That is a treacherous crossing.
It is a treacherous crossing, and I think it's important to remember that people weren't crossing through treacherous terrain like the terrain they currently are until the 2000s. In the mid-90s, Border Patrol changed its enforcement policy to build up enforcement in the easy-to-cross areas and funnel people into the harsh, desolate desert terrain. So there has been this increased militarization in easy-to-cross areas, increasing of agents on the ground, sensors, drones, towers, walls, things like this in the easy-to-cross areas that has really pushed people into, quote, hostile terrain, which is the language that Border Patrol used in its 1994 strategy document. And so us leaving water in the 2,800-square-mile area in which we work, which is a fraction of the U.S.-Mexico border, I think it's absurd to think that people are making their decisions decisions to cross based off of the fact that they might encounter water gallons.
But it's not just that you leave water. You also lead people to shelter places like the barn where they can get food and water. And this is where one of your volunteers was recently arrested outside the barn. But DHS says they operate rescue beacons in this area. If people want help, they should call 911. Border Patrol agents have rescued immigrants in this way. They got a 911 call from four distressed migrants, as they said, who'd been wandering in the desert for 5 days, and Border Patrol agents guided them to a rescue beacon near the town of Ajo, which was where one of your volunteers was arrested for maybe doing the same thing. So they say we are averting deaths. We are helping rescue.
Yeah, I think that is just Border Patrol's attempts at rescuing people and saving people's lives is really a band-aid solution, because the crisis of death and human disappearance we're seeing along the U.S.-Mexico border is a direct result of a policy that started going into place in the mid-90s that has forced people into this terrain. So the idea that Border Patrol is the actor that should be saving people's lives is absurd, because they are creating this crisis in the first place.
Yeah. Well, and as you know, the Border Patrol agents push back by saying, you know, you're doing what you think is right, but we are doing our jobs. I mean, they're doing what they're told to do.
I mean, yeah, the border enforcement strategy has been made in a way to risk people's lives who are crossing. And we see that on the ground with the number of deaths we see. And Border Patrol this summer raided our humanitarian aid station out of Aravaca, Arizona, arresting four people receiving medical care. And now with the arrest of Scott Warren and these videos being leaked of Border Patrol agents from 2010 to 2017 destroying humanitarian aid, it definitely paints a picture that supports the policy. And the policy explicitly is to funnel people into this terrain. People now take anywhere from 3 days to a month to cross, where previously that was just not the reality.
Mm. Alicia Dinsmore, a volunteer with the group No More Deaths, reminding us of what's going on the border as the debate over the wall continues in Washington. Alicia, thank you.
Thank you.
And a Border Patrol spokesman told us the Border Patrol shares a common goal with the non-governmental organizations to preserve human life and to prevent injury. We do not condone or encourage destruction or tampering with any water or food caches. We will hear more down the road. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.